John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spin on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily, and the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto, America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
At fault.
Okay.
But it's not, a lot of what we talk about here actually are murder cases, and this is not a murder situation.
So it's not malicious? Can we say it's not violent?
It's not malicious. It's definitely not malicious. Now,
okay.
This is not a case that's likely to be solved. So I think my end goal here is to have people know a little bit more about this young woman and her story. Now, she went missing with a man, and while I don't want to brush aside his disappearance, because he was important to his family and friends, I really want to focus more on her for this episode.
Okay. Is he still missing?
Yes.
Okay.
So they're missing together.
They're missing together, and I'm sure he was very important to his family and friends. And was he important to Bessie?
Yes.
Okay. So okay. He's important.
Yeah. So we're talking about Bessie Haley. She was born on December 29th, 1905, in Maryland to William and Charlotte Haley. She had one sibling, also named William, who was 5 years younger than her. Growing up, the family lived in West Virginia and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where they lived on Manhattan Street. My husband used to live in Pittsburgh, so it's one of my favorite little cities. It really seems like this family was quite fluid, like mostly moving around Pennsylvania and West Virginia. We do know her father worked in like wallpaper hanging and painting, and this earned him the job title of decorator in census records, which...
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, I'm not sure he would claim, but yeah.
Yeah.
Now, we know that Bessie's family eventually relocates to Parkersburg, West Virginia, and Bessie attended high school there. That's where she was part of something called the Let's Go Club.
That's cute.
Yeah, I don't know what the Let's Go Club would be, but...
I don't know. It sounds very exciting.
The debating club. She was in the class play. She was also on the Quill staff, which was kind of like their yearbook or annual kind of publication. And she did some of the artwork and also wrote some prophecies for her fellow classmates. Like what she thought their futures might.
Really? Help,
but kind of in like a cheeky way.
That's okay.
Yeah. And also on the Quill staff was her high school sweetheart, Earl Helmick. His prophecy was something about like making girls blush.
Aw.
Yeah.
Is Earl the one who goes missing?
No.
Okay.
You're just like.
Well, I'm waiting for him. So Earl is safe.
Earl is safe. Okay. Ish. Okay.
What?
Well, Earl. Okay. When she graduated, Bessie went to Marshall College, which is now known as Marshall University. That's located in Huntington, West Virginia. It's clear she wanted to be an artist, and she took classes in drawing and design while she was there. She was, it seems, still with Earl, though he went to work after graduating from high school. So they're not living in the same town.
Okay.
Now, during her sophomore year, which was 1925 to 1926, Bessie actually moves off campus, like bold move in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
And she started working at the Young Women's Christian Association as a secretary. So to be clear, she is still attending university, just not living on campus. Then on June 5th, 1926, Earl and her elope to Catlettsburg, Kentucky.
So Earl is part of the story still.
Yeah.
Okay.
High school sweethearts run away together.
To get married.
Yeah. Now, this isn't actually a long trip, just probably about a 20-ish minute drive, even then. And the reason they go to Kentucky is that there wasn't a waiting period for marriage license. You could apply and get one the same day and get married the same day. So this is definitely a quickie marriage, and none of their family members are there. There are a lot of rumors about this marriage, right? Quickie marriages always.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Namely around whether or not this happened so quickly because Bessie was pregnant. And there's no hard proof of it, but it is certainly a possibility, right? Now, the next day, there was a brief marriage announcement for the couple in the newspaper, and it indicates that Bessie plans on going to California to study art. And she does. Within 2 months, she was at the California School of Fine Arts in San Francisco, where she continued her studies in art by taking classes in painting and life drawing. She was also a poet and was writing consistently while she was there, enough to gather a collection she called Wandering Leaves. She doesn't get it published, but she kind of gathers together her work. Now, while she was there, she met Arane Granstedt, who was working as a nude model for the figure drawing classes and really seemed to be living her best bohemian artist life fantasy. Except for one thing. It looks like her husband Earl did not travel to San Francisco with her.
I was going to ask that. Where's Earl?
No Earl. So instead, Bessie is living with Arane and Arane's brother, who also worked as a nude model. Now, Arane has her own interesting history, having shot her boyfriend when she was 14. He lived, by the way.
Did she shoot him on purpose?
Oh, well, okay. So Arane, whose real or birth name was Irene.
Why did she change it to Irene?
She...
It's such a weird name compared to Irene, which is such a normal name.
Irene. Well, she was telling people, I think she was from Sweden. She was not. But like, yes, there's two different stories. One, Irene. I'll call her Irene because that was her chosen name.
Yeah.
Irene says it was an accident. Her boyfriend, who she shot, said it was an accident. But Irene's family said it was not and that she was jealous.
Jealous of what?
Him, like,
talking to other girls?
Yeah.
So, wait. Okay. Irene is a very interesting character. So, she's a nude model, but her brother is also a nude model.
Yeah.
And she shot a boy when she was 14, in her opinion, by accident.
Yes.
Changes her name.
Tells people she's from Sweden.
The boyfriend lived, so that's good. So, she's not an actual murderer.
No.
So I don't know. Like, is she a good person? Is she not a good person?
I don't
know. She's kind of fun.
I'm kind of in love with her, and everyone should look her up later. Not under the name Arane, but...
Under what name, then?
Hold on. Okay.
So, you're withholding information.
I know. Arane herself is a fascinating person, and I just really want to deep dive into her life after, like, independently on my own, just because... And she's stunning, too.
We need, like, a non-murdery spin-off episode.
Probably. I could do an Arane.
And, like, have a break from murder for a day.
And just talk about her. Yeah.
I mean, she has a near murder.
But no disappearances.
I know.
Okay. So it's not initially clear why Bessie and Earl separated, but... Keeping in mind that she was married in June of 1926, the following year, in February 1927, she drops out of her classes. Both she and Arane buy one-way tickets on a passenger ship from San Francisco to Los Angeles. Now, Arane is set on becoming a Hollywood star. In fact, she adopts a whole new name. Greta Granstedt, for this endeavor. But it's not clear what Bessie's intentions were for leaving San Francisco. But whatever those goals were, it didn't matter because while she's on board, she meets another passenger by the name of Glenn Hyde.
Is Glenn Hyde the guy she disappears with?
Yes.
So when you said to not Google Irene by Irene, we Google her by Greta.
Look her up by Greta.
Greta's my favorite of her three names so far, I've just got to say.
Oh my god, she ends up total in her life, like marrying 8 times. She is in film. She stars in a bunch of movies. Like, yeah, mostly kind of like as a bit player, but she's still out there.
She's doing her thing.
Okay, so Greta's got this plan. Go become a film star. Bessie, I don't know where her plan is, but she meets Glenn on this boat. Now, Glenn's a bit older than Bessie. At this point, she's 21 and he's 28, and it's hard to tell exactly what draws them together at first. She's this married artist going to school in San Francisco, and he's from a farming family in rural Idaho and was working as a secretary for the local irrigation district. But by all accounts, from the moment they met on the ship, the two are practically inseparable. He brings her to meet his family in Idaho, and she brings him to see her family in West Virginia.
Okay, so we are really just departing from Earl here completely.
Yes, so she's still married.
Just like, she's still married, but we are totally into Glenn. Glenn's the guy.
Is it for her, okay. Right? Okay, she's married, right? So she goes to West Virginia. She's bringing along Glenn. Earl shows up at her family's house. And there's, like, apparently a bit of a dust-up between Earl and Glenn.
Well, do you blame him?
No.
No.
And she tries to get her husband, Earl, to agree to a divorce, but he's not budging. He's still trying to get her to come home with him. And he, like, I don't know, the refusal to divorce. I don't know at this point if it's a power thing or wishful thinking that she'll come back to him eventually. I don't know.
Like, why would you want to force someone to be married to you that doesn't want to be?
Yeah, I don't get what's happening between them here. But Bessie is not having it, right? Now, divorce laws varied by state during this time. I mean, they still do. But some of them could be pretty strict back in the 1920s. Like New York, where we live, for instance, would only grant a divorce based on adultery. And that's if you actually had eyewitnesses to the affair. And even then, you would have to wait a year between, like, filing and getting the divorce.
The eyewitness thing makes me laugh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Think about, like, how many women were, like, gathering friends. Yeah. For, like,
go peep in my windows at this time when I'm supposed to be out at bingo. Like, yeah.
I mean, this actually makes me wonder because, like, my grandmother got divorced. Well, she was, like, in the 1940s. So quite a bit later, but yeah.
And if you wanted a divorce, could you like have a friend just go and like try to trick your husband into initiating an affair?
I have no idea.
And then be her own witness?
Okay. If you are fascinated with New York laws, you are going to be fascinated with this because I was. There are states like Nevada where the laws were vastly more lenient. They had actually 9 different reasons you could file for divorce. According to one article I read, these included impotency, adultery, desertion, conviction of a felony, habitual drunkenness, neglect to provide the common necessities of life, insanity, living apart for 3 years, and extreme cruelty, entirely mental in nature.
Okay, so I like Nevada.
Yeah, and none of them required proof.
These are great reasons. My favorite, though, is neglect to provide the common necessities of life. Like, right. I want more fancy things. I shall divorce you.
Okay. None of those required proof, though. So you could just pick anyone off the list.
And just go for it.
Yeah. And also, there was no waiting period.
Yeah, so Nevada wins.
Yeah, Nevada was, like, really
doing it.
But the problem was, is, like, to get a divorce in Nevada, you actually had to be a resident of Nevada, right? Now, at the time, in Nevada, you had to be a resident of Nevada for 6 months before filing. That does get changed in 1931 to 6 weeks, which, by the way, created a huge tourism boom in Nevada, and it became one of the divorce capitals of the United States. And what I love is that there were these things called divorce ranches.
Seriously? How come I've never heard of this before?
Oh my God, I'm just in love with this. So you could go and hang out, do a bunch of dude ranch stuff, all just while waiting for your divorce
to happen. A six-week trip?
Yeah.
To Nevada to, like, hang out on a dude ranch. And now you get the divorce you've always wanted.
Yes.
That's worth it.
Yeah. And flirt with, like,
all the cute ranch boys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. But it's 6 weeks in 1931. But when Bessie wants to divorce, it's much sooner than that. And we're in the 6 month period. So now, Reno became the hot spot for these types of divorces, but we know that Bessie moved to Nevada in November 1927 to start her residency, and she ends up filing for divorce in Elko, Nevada. Now, during this court process, there is documentation of questions Bessie was asked during this divorce proceedings. She basically says the plan when she got married to Earl was always for her to go to art school and for him to stay behind and work. She said that they lived together for 2 months, but he seemed indifferent to whether she stayed or left.
So did she pick one of those 9 reasons?
Yeah, I don't know which of the 9 she picked, but they did grant her divorce.
Oh, maybe the living apart? No, because it wasn't 3 years.
Yeah. So her divorce is granted April 11th, 1928. And the next day, she married Glenn in Twin Falls, Idaho.
Well, I mean, how long have they been together at this point?
So this is they met in February the year before. It's now April, so a year and like a few months.
And they've
been
waiting for this for 6 months, so we can excuse the extremely fast.
Yeah, she was like, we're getting married. Okay, so from April through that summer, the two are working on the family farm, which is in part a bean farm.
Also adorable.
But I get the impression for both of them, like, this was making them a bit stir crazy.
Are they too wild for the bean farm?
They are too wild for the bean farm. So before I get into what happens next, there's a few things that you need to know about Glenn since I haven't talked about him too much. Glenn is what I'm going to call an outdoor cat.
Why an outdoor cat?
He's the hiking, camping, river boating kind of guy. Like, he's basically my worst nightmare as a partner.
Your partner is not like this.
My partner is not
no
like this.
So those are the kind of people I call golden retrievers. See, like the excited outdoor, like enthusiast, the one that's like going to run through the streams and...
Yeah. Well, so I wouldn't say he necessarily has a golden retriever personality.
Oh, he doesn't. Okay.
But that's why I called him
more on the cat side.
That's why I called him an outdoor cat.
Okay. So yeah. He's just like unexcitedly hiking, camping, and river boating.
He's excited about those things. I'm an indoor cat. Like, bring me snacks and blankets and books and tea and like Bridgerton, right? Like, yeah.
Are you on Bridgerton right now?
I mean, season 3, bit rocky for me.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. But he is like all of these outdoor things. And when Glenn was 19, he really starts taking up river boating or river rafting. I'm not sure what to call it exactly because I think on all of these river trips, he's in something called a flat-bottomed scow.
Do we know if a flat-bottomed scow is a boat or a raft?
It is a boat.
Is it a boat-raft hybrid?
Well, okay. So I just recently found out that my ancestors were canalmen in France. So I'm going to feel the weight of their judgment through history on this one. But from my understanding and researches, these are kind of like flat-bottomed barges. That's what they were used for. They were used to carry freight on inland waterways like rivers.
What?
They're not huge.
So they're freight boats?
They're not huge, but like they can transport a lot of weight.
Are they not supposed to be for people?
They're for people. People are on the flat bottom scow.
Okay, why are we taking that down a river?
Because they're designed for rivers.
Oh, are they? Okay, but...
Yeah.
Okay, I'm thinking like white water rafting. It's not...
Oh, yes. Well, hold on.
Yeah. Wait, are we white water rafting in
We're going to white water rafting.
In a barge type boat?
Yes. So during my research, I also learned that the boat that was stuck above Niagara Falls for 100 years was a scow.
Oh, okay. So we're deep diving into scows.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, the canalmen of my ancestry would probably be like, what the heck?
Yeah.
This is what my lineage did.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Glenn has done some rivers, like the Peace River in Alberta. And I'm going to back up for a second here and say that even as an indoor cat, I know that there are white water ratings that now exist to help classify rapids for the more adventurous people who are out there doing those river things. And the Peace River that he went down.
Wait, so there weren't classifications on those rivers? You were just like taking your chances, blindly going onto any river without knowing the intensity of that river? Is that what kind of classifications?
Yeah.
Yikes. Yeah. Okay, so that seems like something that should have always been in place.
Some of these river ratings exist are a bit older than others, right? The international system doesn't arrive until later, but we now have an international system of ratings, right? And so the Peace River is a class one, meaning that there aren't rapids.
Nice.
Yeah. So he's done the Peace River. And he's also done things like the Salmon River. In fact, in 1926, so that's the year before he met Bessie, he and his sister Jean take a scow down the Salmon River. And like, look, he's no expert, but the Salmon River in Oregon is a class three. So this is considered like an intermediate level river rapid situation. And it does take some skill to handle. And what happens here is he gets a lot of praise from people along the way who tell him and others how well he's handled the scow through these rapids.
So he's feeling very good at this.
Yes. So if you got Mr. Outdoor Adventure married to Bohemian Artist and they're literally stuck on a bean farm in Idaho, like, I don't think either of them imagined this as their life, right?
Okay.
And the two of them start thinking about what they can do with their lives, how they want to live, what is in their power to do. Now, it's clear that the two of them are keenly aware what I'm going to call celebrity culture at the time. Like, it's Mary Pickford, who popularized the Nevada divorce thing in the 1920s. And one of the ongoing themes in 1920s news coverage is the idea of adventure. So you've got Charles Lindbergh and Amelia Earhart. They're flying around. You've got Clyde Eddy, who decides to go down the Colorado River, accompanied by a bear cub from the New York Zoo. So there's all this news around that centers adventuring, and the Hydes decide that they're going to capitalize on that. They're going to run the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon.
Okay. Has Bessie ever done the scow thing?
Bessie has not done the whitewater rafting on scow, nor any other...
She's never whitewater rafted. Has she river rafted without the whitewater part?
It's unclear if they did any, okay. Like...
But I do feel like it was an adventure-y time by the Let's Go Club.
Yeah. Like, what is the Let's Go Club? I don't know.
I don't know.
Okay. To understand, though, why they're picking the Colorado River, of course, it's been in the news. Mm-hmm. Like, you've got the guy with the bear cub situation. The second thing is that going through the Grand Canyon on the Colorado had, at this point, rarely been done. And I'd like to add that the history of this is largely documented by white people, so our understanding of how often this was accomplished and by whom is limited to white people perspective, right? So we know the guy who is first credited with this is Joseph Wesley Powell, who went down in 1869. And I'm guessing some of our listeners are thinking there's been a lot of time between 1869 and 1928, and surely this has been done countless times, but it really hasn't. We're talking about less than 10 times at this point because the rapids in the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon can be so intense.
Mm-hmm.
But the real key here is that up to this point, there is no documentation of a woman going down the Colorado. It's unclear who initiated this idea, but really without Bessie on board for this, it's honestly, it wouldn't have gotten much media attention. I mean, like that guy had to bring a bear cub to create a spectacle, right?
So are we doing this as like a publicity thing?
Well, kind of, because they have a plan. So the Colorado River is like step one of the plan. That they'll do this trip and then they'll be able to use it as a means to travel around on the like lecture circuit, maybe reenact it in vaudeville. And
really? So wait, this is just like, so if these people were alive today, would they be like social media travel influencers?
Yes.
So we are looking at like an Instagram,
yeah,
hiker, travel, adventurist.
Yeah, and in fact, like there's actually quite a few photos from their trip because they brought like a camera.
It's so funny because we think of this as such like a modern thing that's happening now, but this is like Bessie's doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're going to do this. They're going to leverage this experience, right? Now, again, to revisit what we just said, Bessie has no experience with running rivers.
That's unfortunate.
And I'm honestly, I'm going to call Glenn's experience as marginal at best. But they decide they're going to do it. And they spend the summer making plans and reading whatever they could about this area and the river itself, right? And when the harvest season on the bean farm ends, they're out of there.
But I mean, taking into account their lack of experience makes sense because, as you said earlier, this is a podcast dedicated to missing persons. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
So the two head to Green River, Utah, which is where the guy with the bear or cub started his trip. Mm-hmm. It's October, and Glenn starts to build the scow himself along the river. Now, this part was met with a lot of skepticism from those who lived along the Green River and had done parts of the Colorado or had heard about it. Bill Reeder, who had been through Cataract Canyon in a trip that sunk quite a few boats, recalled talking to Glenn, who he called surly, conceited, and stupid.
I don't think those are good words.
No.
Those are bad compliments.
No. Now, this recollection from Bill Reeder, this comes many years later, but according to him, he talked to Glenn, who was confident in his abilities due to his time on the Salmon River. Mm-hmm. Reeder also asked if they were taking life preservers with them, and Glenn claimed that they wouldn't be needed.
I feel like they're always needed. Can we take a moment to PSA that life preservers are always needed?
Yes. I mean, two things. One, thanks to the research from an author I'll mention in a little bit, apparently life preservers were rarely used by Idahoan people on rivers.
Because?
It just was not done at this time.
So it's not cool.
Not cool. I will also say that as someone who lives on a lake, mm-hmm. and actually a lake that gets quite big waves, right? I see people on watercraft all the time without life vests.
And as someone who likes to read the ranger reports regularly, mm-hmm. if you do not make it in a water incident and there is a life preserver on your boat or near your body, the rangers will mention it.
Yes.
And it's not a fun type of addition to the article. Because the life preserver should be on the body.
Yes.
And the body should still be alive.
Yes.
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 So.
Yeah. I mean, I can't tell you how shocking it is sometimes just to like look out from my house and see people go by.
Especially if they're alone.
Yeah.
Like if you are alone, you put the preserver on. Please. All the time. Please.
I also see people heading out when there's like. My phone is giving me, like, weather warnings. So Glenn is not...
Yeah, being alive is worth more to me than being cool.
Right. But yeah. Glenn was like...
He's cool.
We don't need it.
Yeah.
And so Bill Reeder's like, hey, are you going to bring a water bag in case you have to hike out of the canyon? And again, he says, oh, those aren't needed.
I don't know what a water bag is.
Like, basically, like a way to bring transport water with you. So today
we like drinking water.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we're not bringing drinking water either?
You're not bringing, like, one that can be, like, transported up, like, hiking, right? So, okay. Like, today we would have, like, our Nalgene's or...
Yeah.
Our
cups. Our little cuppy cups.
Yeah.
Okay. So no life preservers, no water in case we need to hike out.
Because they're not going to have to, basically. No. On October 20th, with the scow complete, Bessie and Glenn left Green River on the Green River. Mm-hmm. Now, this scow is controlled by sweeps that help turn and maneuver the boat, so Bessie would have to learn how to control hers.
So that's the steery thing.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to pause here and say that the book, Sunk Without a Sound by Brad Dimcock, was essential in creating this episode. He and his wife actually built a replica of the Hyde scow and took it onto the Colorado. So if you're interested in more of Glenn's history or scows themselves or a more detailed explanation of how that journey progressed, I highly recommend it.
So is that book more about Glenn?
Yeah, I mean... Glenn's story kind of dominates, I feel like.
In that, okay.
Yeah.
Is there a documentary about these two?
I don't know.
There should be.
There should be, yeah. So what Brad Timcock emphasizes in his book is that one advantage of a scout is that it can actually transport an immense amount of weight. So Bessie and Glenn had set out with things like potatoes from the farm and a mattress spring that they can sleep on in the scout.
Is that not going to get wet?
Well, it's the spring, and so then they're putting their, like...
Oh, it's just the okay.
They're bedding on top of it, right?
Okay.
And apparently you can even pour sand on the bottom of a scout and light fire if need be for, like, cooking. Yeah.
Okay. I've never heard of anyone making a fire inside their boat.
Yeah, apparently you can if necessary.
So scouts are the way to travel. Because you can have, like, a fire and room for your mattress springs.
Yeah,
and your potatoes.
In some situations, it seems like a scout would be cool now.
Yes, very, very cool.
So this type of watercraft looks, as one townsperson put it, like a coffin. It does have these clear advantages, though, while traveling. Now, on October 27th, Bessie and Glenn finally made it off the Green River, and they're heading into the Colorado. And this means that Bessie now has 7 days' experience in maneuvering the scout. Their first big rapid experience is through the Cataract Canyon, which has up to Class 4 to Class 5 rapids. So those are on par or one step above the difficulty with the rapids Glenn and his sister faced on the Salmon. So
a little bit difficult.
A little bit difficult. So even today, with the advancements in boat types and ease of gathering information about the river, there have been deaths within the last 20 years in Cataract Canyon. And it's in Cataract that Bessie falls into the river. I haven't said this yet, but Bessie is incredibly tiny. She's just over 5 feet tall and maybe about 90 pounds. So she's going to get flung around in different ways than her husband. And I honestly would say he's got close to a foot of height on her, and maybe he's at least twice her weight.
He's still quite thin, though. I've seen the pictures.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're not a big couple.
No.
But he is markedly... Taller,
yeah.
So wait, is this where it stops? Is this where it ends?
No.
Okay.
No. Okay, so she gets flung into the river, and he basically saves her by grabbing her foot and hauling her back in.
Okay.
Yeah.
Whew. So we already almost died.
Yeah. So now, apparently, this near disaster does change how they do things. In the biggest rapids, apparently, Glenn takes both sweeps so that Bessie's not going to get flung around like she was through Cataract Canyon. So there's at least an acknowledgement that this was a close call.
Okay, so adjustments have been made.
Yes.
We'll be back in a moment.
And this trip through does take them days. It's roughly 48 miles long with a series of various rapids throughout. According to Brad Dimcock's previously, a lot of people who had been in Cataract had portaged their boat, meaning taken it out and carried it past the biggest drops in the rapids. But this is not really an option for the Hydes for the most part, because Dimcock estimates that their boat, when wet, weighed roughly 2 tons.
They can't do that then. So in the worst part of the rapids, you're supposed to just carry it around, which sounds really reasonable to me.
Yeah. So like at some point, people are like, whoop. That's a little too much.
So they're in this 2-ton boat, and they're just doing it.
Yeah, so apparently some people feel that at different parts in their journey, it looks like they were able to portage their boat, but everyone's like unclear on how they managed to do that given its like weight and size, right? Okay. But for the most part, they've got to go through.
How can it weigh 2 tons?
Yeah. And how would they lift it? I don't know. It's huge and heavy.
Okay.
Now, they continued on there into much calmer waters, and they reached Lee's Ferry in Arizona on November 8th, which is 2 days ahead of their schedule. Now, Lee's Ferry was and is an important river crossing for the Colorado River, and as such, became an outpost. So back in the day, there was, maybe obviously from its name, a ferry that could transport travelers back and forth across the river. Now, I don't think the Hydes got the kind of reception they were expecting at Lee's Ferry. They were universally told to stop their journey, that their boat wasn't the right type, and that it was too dangerous to go on. On the other hand, they do run into a reporter from a local Arizona newspaper, and he briefly includes them in a story, which I'm going to say is important interaction for the Hydes, since ultimately they want to leverage this experience into careers for themselves.
So did the newspaper article kind of like overshadow this big warning that they've been given?
No, it's kind of more like a couple on a honeymoon trip.
But that, like, in their heads, was it like the encouragement they needed to go on instead of just stopping?
I think like
they should.
You know, they don't end up ultimately seeing the newspaper report, right? But I think that interacting with reporters is exactly like what they're looking for.
Fueling that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So even though they've been on this journey for a few weeks, this is really one of the times that we can see documentation of reactions to them and understand a bit more of what's going on with them. Now, it's important to add that many of these recollections were recorded many years later. So Owen Clark, who worked as a water gauger in Lee's Ferry, said that Bessie seemed enthusiastic about the trip and Glenn seemed confident. Price Johnson, whose family operated the ferry, appraised them of the risks, including that three ferrymen had recently been washed away and drowned. He says that Glenn didn't really seem fazed by this, but that Bessie seemed nervous. And Buck Lowry, who had a small trading post not far from Lee's Ferry, said that Bessie didn't seem to want to quit.
How would you feel if you got somewhere and somebody's like, this is the wrong boat, people are dying? Would you be just like, yeah, that makes me a bit nervous, but I'm excited to keep going?
Not me. No, 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 no. No. But I'm...
But you're an indoor cat and you wouldn't have been on this boat in the first place.
I would not have been on this boat, right? No.
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 You would have been happily on the bean farm reading some books.
Yes, I would be like, give me a shade tree. Oh, it's winter. Perfect. More books.
And the farm would have lots of room for dogs.
Yeah.
It would be nice.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All the puppies.
All the puppies, all the books, all the shade trees.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're staying in. We're not going on the boat. Okay. In his own letter to his father, though, that was posted from Lee's Ferry, Glenn wrote, I'd quit river here, not on my own account, though, but from what they tell us, we are over all the worst water.
What does that mean? I'd quit river here?
Yeah, well, so breaking this down, it seems like he feels like he has to go on. So is Bessie...
He thinks they've passed the worst part?
Yeah, well, so is Bessie pushing them forward? Is it not Glenn? Did he want to stop for her sake? And then the thing about the worst water, we know that, A, it's not true from the accounts of those at Lee's Ferry who said, hey, give this up.
Yeah.
And B, not true from what we know about the river today.
Right. And he said he'd quit it. So, what's happening?
Yes. So once the couple leave Lee's Ferry, they are officially in Grand Canyon territory. So even though they've gone quite a ways already, mile zero is Lee's Ferry, and then it's over 200 miles until they're out. Despite claiming they are over the worst water, at mile 79.1, they encounter the Sauk Dolliger Rapid. Now, the Grand Canyon Rapids today have their own rating scale that differs from the international scale we were talking about earlier. So for the Grand Canyon, it's a 1 to 10 scale. And Sauk Dolliger is rated a 7, which means it can present some difficulty in navigating. Glenn later writes to his father that during these rapids, an oar hits him under the chin, and the next thing you know, he's in the water. He went under a few times before he manages to grab a hold of the boat, and Bessie has to help haul him in.
So two close calls now at this point.
Yes.
That we know of.
That we know of, yes. And so while he seems to take this in stride, Bessie writes, I was ready to climb the canyon wall right then and there, but Glenn laughed at me.
So now she's ready to quit.
Yeah.
They both sound kind of like unsure, or they're saying in the letters what they were thinking family members wanted to hear.
Yeah, it's...
I don't know. It would have been good if they would have just...
Quit. But they did not. And the next day they stop at Bright Angel Creek, which is where they're able to take the Kaibab Trail up out of the canyon, and they hitch a ride into Grand Canyon, Arizona, the town.
Okay. Right.
Now, newspapers reported that the couple stayed at the El Tovar Hotel, which by the way, is now the oldest running hotel in Grand Canyon National Park. But this hotel was, even then, far above their budget. They can't afford to stay there, so they stayed nearby in a camp, in a tent, basically. In Grand Canyon, though, they bought supplies for their trip. They also spoke to a reporter from the Denver Post about their travels. And so remember, it's in their best interest to gain as much attention for this trip as possible. Mm-hmm. So that's another boon for them. And of Glenn's accident, Bessie says in this article, "We carried no life preservers. I admit I was scared to death. I can't remember clearly all that happened."
Did they buy life preservers now?
Vanessa. And then later, she continues saying, "Our main object in taking this trip is to give me a thrill. It's surely been successful so far. I've had thrills of my life, and I've been thoroughly drenched a dozen times, but I'm enjoying every minute."
I'm not a thrill seeker. I don't think I would want to be drenched every minute.
No, no. So it's clear that, at least in front of the reporter, Bessie is painting this experience in a very positive light.
But I think it's also cool that they're doing what they want to do.
Right.
That's cool, too.
Yes. Now, one of the people that they run into in Grand Canyon is Emery Kolb. And Emery and his brother Ellsworth had, in 1911, and I think 2 years later, done what the Hydes were trying to do. They'd been down the Colorado and documented their trip on film, and when they were done, they went on a lecture tour. And by the time the Hydes run into him, this film is played at their photography studio in Grand Canyon, Arizona. Now, Emery speaks to the Hydes. He invites them to one of his lectures. He also takes two portraits of them. In one, both of them are smiling. Now, 2 months after he met them, Emery writes to another river guy that he did his best to convince them to take life preservers of some sort with them, but they refused. Much later in 1940, Emery writes to Barry Goldwater and again says that they refused life preservers. He even offered inner tubes and they didn't want them. And here he writes, "We believe the bride ready to quit here."
Okay, so they're not feeling it from her, but they're still refusing the life preservers.
Yes.
I have a feeling that this story would not exist had life preservers been used. Or it would be a different story, one we are not covering.
Yeah. So other people who were interviewed about their experience with the Hydes in Grand Canyon echo kind of these statements that Emery said, though it seemed that she wanted to stop, right?
Mm-hmm.
In her letters, though, Bessie claims that they've been told that the worst of the rapids are over, and they expected to make to their destination, Needles, California, on time. Now, in the end, she doesn't quit. When they finally returned to the scow with more supplies, they came across this man, Adolph Sutro. He's kind of this wealthy guy that's kind of tromping around the Grand Canyon area, and he's there, like, checking out the scow. And like many others, he's intrigued by what the Hydes are doing and by their boat, and so he asks if he can just tag along.
Do they let him?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Come on our boat, stranger.
Yeah. I don't know. So on November 17th, the three of them set out, and almost immediately they're caught into what Brian Dimcock calls in his book a recirculating eddy, and that there was a witness to this, John Bear, a tourist who wrote, "The swift water making a bend created a whirlpool, and the couple appeared unable to manage the scow." He said they got it out only to be sucked back in. Eventually, he left to go find them help, but when he returned, it looks like the three had successfully made it out and continued down the river.
So they're out, and Sutro's still alive?
Sutro is still alive, right?
Okay.
And Sutro is actually interviewed years later about his experience on the boat with them. Of this interview, apparently there's only notes, but he says that despite his river experience, he was scared during his time with them and described Bessie as being terrified. He said she registered stark fear. He said they did an overnight and that he wasn't exactly impressed by their setup when they got off for the night. And he says their conversations really centered around how to make this adventure earn money, and that, in his words, the feminine angle is essential to this.
Okay.
He then goes on to say that Glenn was materializing spirit and that he wasn't the type to settle down. Of Bessie, he said she would never have run the river.
So we're really thinking at this point that Glenn is just out to make money off of Bessie?
Yeah, so there is no way that he can really leverage this experience without her, right?
Because so she would be really the first not Bessie, woman. Like, choice at this point.
It really seems what Sutro is saying is that Bessie is clearly scared.
Okay.
Other people at Grand Canyon also had said that she seemed to, like, want to quit. And we also know from Bessie's letter that she wrote she wanted to quit when Glenn went in and he laughed at her, right?
Okay. So this isn't... Yeah, I thought it was more voluntary than it seems to be shaping up to be.
Yeah, there is, like, part of her is, like, publicly saying, like, I'm excited for this trip and it's a thrill, but then... Other people are saying that when they encountered her, she seemed scared. Their recollections are many years later. So is it true that she seemed that way, or is that just tainted by what you know happens?
Like hindsight, right? Yeah.
But we do know in her letter she said she wanted to leave and he laughed at her.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I have lots of thoughts about this, but...
Yeah.
Sutro does make clear that he found Glenn not to be domineering, but he did find him to be irresponsible. Now, Sutro, he leaves this trip as soon as possible, like as soon as they get to a place where he can get a trail out of there. He'd later say, "My unfailing guiding light in life has been the precept that it is better to live a coward than a dead hero. It has permitted me to avoid many perils, such as wing walking on aeroplanes, running for political office, or committing matrimony. So in accordance with the foregoing, may I point out with pride that I disembarked permanently at the very first possible landing spot. A rather comprehensive experience in sailing small boats in the North Pacific assisted me in formulating my judgment."
I kind of really like this guy. There are some really good characters along the way, right?
I mean, like, I feel like...
Walking on airplane wings in the same group as running for political office and getting married.
Yeah. And also, like, he's... It's like a cheeky way of saying it, but he's definitely saying, like, look, this was not a risk to take,
right? I didn't feel safe and I'm not doing this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so Sutro actually takes what is the last known photo of the pair. And even though it hasn't been that long since they left Grand Canyon and got their photos taken there by Emery Kolb, there is a marked difference in their appearance. Like, honestly, they both look a bit haunted. And knowing what I know, this picture feels ominous. Like, Bessie looks wide-eyed. She's unsmiling. Like, Glenn looks grim.
Not as happy.
No.
No.
No. Now, we know the couple made it to what's called Hermit Camp. This, in its heyday, was a popular destination. People would take the trail down to the camp, but at this point, it's mid-November, so it's not exactly high tourism season.
I think I'm going to start calling my house Hermit Camp.
Hermit Camp. Now, later, a mule packer by the name of Bob Francie claims that the people at the camp overheard the couple arguing during an overnight. And that Glenn forced Bessie onto the scow. Now, Bob Dimcock points out that the couple did not spend the night at the camp, as Francie claims, making it hard to take his account as factual. He also says that they couldn't find anyone to corroborate this since there were so few people there and they couldn't be found later for interviews. So we just have Bob Francie's thoughts on this. We do know, though, that the Hydes left Hermit Camp on November 18th. Now, Crystal Rapid, which is a significant rapid of today's Colorado River, was not there in 1928, but they did have Hermit Rapid, which is rated an 8 on the Grand Canyon scale ahead. And despite what Bessie did trying to downplay what was ahead, the reality is that there are quite a few more rapids to traverse in this section of the river.
Are they ever seen after being at Hermit Camp?
No.
New.
So, as Bessie had said, the couple had planned to arrive at Needles, California in a few weeks. It was actually planned for December 9th, which would have been Glenn's 30th birthday. They then planned to meet his father, R.C. Hyde, in L.A. Now, R.C. was already worried about this trip, And when Bessie and Glenn didn't arrive on the 9th, he was poised and ready to go immediately to find them. At this point, they could have just been delayed in their travels, but like RC knew. He sets out and he starts gathering people and resources to find the pair. He gets to Griggs Ferry, which is another outpost, and this one is located after the Grand Canyon ended. The couple would absolutely need to pass through this point, but when RC talks to the brothers who run the outpost, he learns that they haven't seen the couple. So this confirms to RC that something is wrong. By December 16th, the first news coverage of the missing couple hits the papers, and their story is covered in newspapers across the country. By the 17th, Bessie's dad meets with the West Virginia governor, and he calls up the Secretary of War.
Wait, what's that going to do?
Well, hold on. There's even meetings with President Coolidge about the hides being missing.
Okay, they went.
They went.
Right to the top.
Right up to the top, yeah. Which is how the Army Corps ends up sending out planes to search for them.
Would this have been typical? I don't feel like there's usually this much energy that goes into.
No, but like you have like a young,
is it because they're kind of famous couple at this point?
They've gotten some press coverage. Like, you know, some of those stories that those reporters had done had been picked up by the AP, so they were carried in newspapers across the country. So people were more aware of them. Like, they knew that you had, like, your first woman attempting to do the Colorado. Like,
they're put into, like, this adventure category, yeah, probably. Where...
And so it's, like, a big splashy kind of news story situation. So the Army Corps is sending out these planes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can't believe, like, the president knew.
Right.
Yeah. At the same time, like, there are several ground searches taking place, like, R.C. Hyde, Glenn's dad, he sends a telegram to Emery Kolb, who is actually down in Phoenix, Arizona, to be with a friend who is dying. But he returns immediately, Emery does. And his brother Ellsworth, who at this point is living in California, sees a newspaper article that his brother is going to search for the Hydes, and he leaves and heads to the Grand Canyon as well.
So everybody's going. And so, wait, Emery and Ellsworth... Were they people they met along the way, or?
Oh, do you want to
ask? I need a refresher.
You need that. A refresher on who?
I need a refresher on who Emery and Ellsworth are. Okay. Although I will say that their parents did an excellent job naming them, because those are very nice names.
Oh my God. And they're like, they're young photos? Handsome.
Handsome with nice names.
Yeah. Okay. So, okay. Emery and Ellsworth did a 1911 trip down.
Okay, they're the two brothers that made it successfully.
Yes.
Okay.
And so they're one of the few people with, like, experience on the river.
I know you mentioned them earlier, but then I couldn't.
Yeah. And so they had the photography studio, and Emery was, like.
But they had they met the other couple in person?
So Emery had. Just briefly.
Okay.
Emery is the one who's, like, take life preservers. Like, yes. You have, like, a man who has survived this trip telling you to take life preservers, telling you, like, at least take inner tubes. And you're saying,
no.
Like, I can't.
Let's listen to Emery.
Yes. And Ellsworth, his brother, you know, had done the trip. At this point, he was living in California. But they basically, like, reunite the team to find this couple. So they're out there. They're searching. And on December 19th, those aerial searches find the scow at mile 237, and it's stuck in, it seemed in the rapids from what they could tell. So they come back, they land, and Emery Kolb, he goes up in the plane to get a better look, and they take the plane down within 50 feet of the scow. Emery says at one point he almost like fell out of the plane. Yeah.
That's a lot.
You're taking a plane like really far.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this helps them confirm that this boat is the Hydes, and that their gear was actually still inside the scow. The next day, the pilots dropped messages to ground searchers to tell them where the scow was. They also dropped notes near the scow in case the Hydes were nearby. At this point, though, it's been a month since they were last seen. And the Kolbs, they set out in their own boat. On Christmas Eve, they spot the scow, and the next day they're able to search the vessel. It's about 30 feet from the shore. It's actually in calm water, but it seems to be like the rope is caught up. And inside is all the Hyde's gear, and they note that there's 42 notches carved on the bow, one for each day of their travel. They left Hermit Camp on day 30, so this is 12 days of travel that they've done covering from Hermit at mile 95-ish, and their boat is at mile 237.
So they still did travel quite far since Hermit Camp.
Mm-hmm. Now, just about everything is in the scow, minus Bessie and Glenn. So they collect some of the items from there. But the thing is, the search party really can't bring everything back. The scow is heavier, it carried a lot more, and they're not sure what to do with it. And so they end up cutting it loose, and it eventually ends up smashing downriver with no one on it to guide it. They later say the Culps say they regret cutting it loose just in case it could have been searched later mm-hmm. for more evidence. But I think it was just one of those decisions in the moment.
Like what do we do with this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So at this point, with the hides nowhere to be seen, I think there's some consensus that they might have drowned. And there's conflicting thought on that, of course. Their boat was upright. Their goods are still inside. But we do know that both Bessie and Glenn had gone overboard before without there needing to be like a catastrophic failure of the scow, right?
Mm-hmm.
Still, even receiving this news, RC doesn't give up looking for his son and daughter-in-law. And on December 30th, another search team reports that it has spotted Glenn's tracks along the bank at mile 217 Rapids. So that's 10 miles up from where their boat was found. They found them going out and back down to the scow, as well as drag marks from the scow being pulled back in the water.
So is there a possibility they didn't drown and that they disappeared somewhere trying to hike out?
Well, so one of the nephews, I think, of Glenn, he said that, you know, they had told him that if something happened, that they would just camp in the canyon and just wait for rescue. Like, they didn't have intentions of hiking out if they came across something. It has now been a month since they were last seen.
Right. And how often do boats go through that would rescue them?
Yeah.
Not that often.
Not that often. And it's also November.
Right.
So we do know that at, you know, mile 217, so that's above where they were, you've got Glenn's footprints going
mm-hmm.
in and back out. So there's that. Now, tensions are certainly high. A newspaper ran an editorial saying basically that their disappearance should serve as a warning to other thrill seekers. And Jean, Glenn's sister, takes an exception to this, and she writes her own letter to the editor. She emphasizes that they were not foolhardy, and they knew about the river and what they would be facing. She said, "Mrs. Hyde shares my brother's love for adventure, and knowing his skill with boats in the past, was anxious to go on the Colorado River trip." And so I'm interrupting Jean here to say, mm-hmm. yes, he did have prior experience, but Bessie didn't, and he didn't have experience on a river with this level of rapids.
Right. Also, do you really truly think that the newspaper is overstepping by saying that? Because I can see taking offense to it if it's your loved one, but I can also see wanting to protect other people.
Right. Like that you shouldn't just attempt this, right?
Right.
Particularly because there'd been so much coverage of like adventure sports, right?
Right. I mean, yeah. It goes back to kind of like that, those ranger reports I read where they do point out when the safety gear is right there and a person doesn't use it. Like, is that a disservice to the person or is it a service to anyone else who might have their life saved by it?
Yeah. You know, in thinking about this, I was like, oh God, there's like these series of great TikToks. You're not on TikTok anymore.
I'm not.
It's by journalist Mel Hamlet, and she herself had been a whitewater guide. I don't know where. But one of the things that she talks about is basically the risks that overconfident men place women in, like these dangerous situations that
I think some women can be pretty overconfident too, yeah, to mean, be fair.
Like, you know, not to take away Bessie's agency here.
Right. She started out overconfident. That might have dwindled as she went.
Well, I think in some ways, like believing in his skills and abilities, yeah. Right? And I get what Jean is saying here mm-hmm. that Bessie is an adventurous sort. Like, she definitely is. But at the same time, I think everyone has really oversold his experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, his sister is definitely going to be someone who's like defending them on their choices.
Exactly. So Jean continues and she says, "She did not go for notoriety and neither did he." But like, Jean, that's not true. Like, we know that they had a plan for how they would capitalize on their success, right?
Right.
Yeah. So then she basically goes on to say that this was really a couple who loved to adventure, much like their ancestors did.
Do we know that their ancestors liked to adventure?
I mean, I think that she's like pointing out that like, oh, you know, back in the day of adventuring people, you know, like, I don't know.
Okay.
I guess some of my ancestors were more adventure-y than others, but
Okay.
But this, I think it's like this idea of like being in nature and hunting and hiking and rafting, right?
Yeah. I mean, I agree with how she probably felt about the situation, but I don't agree with her assessment of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So despite her assertions, the fact remains the couple is still missing, mm-hmm. and additional searches were launched early the next year. Even Jean goes out as well looking for them, but no sign of them is ever found. It's believed by many that Bessie and Glenn likely died going through mile 232 rapid, which is known as Killer Fang Falls.
Yeah.
It's believed their boat then drifted down to mile 237 where it got caught up and found by the search parties. Some people actually call this rapid section Honeymoon Rapids, Honeymoon Falls, because the couple was there.
Now, way at the beginning of this episode, when you said it was going to be considered like missing or death by misadventure, you said mm-hmm. some people wouldn't agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
What part of it?
Okay, so there are theories.
Do people think he murdered her? And then ran away?
Like, no.
What do they think?
No. Okay. So there are some theories. Okay. And pervasive myths about this couple, particularly about Bessie, not Glenn. In 1970, there's this commercial rafting trip. Commercial rafting had started in like the 50s, I believe, in Grand Canyon. But all these people are on a tour and they're doing a campfire night. And one of the women in the group announced that she was actually Bessie and that she had murdered her husband.
Really? That happened?
Yeah.
In 1970, so how old would this woman be that's saying this? Like 50?
Well, so Bessie, that's like another, I can math, that's another 40 years. So yeah. That she would have been in her 60s. Yeah.
So a woman says that she's Bessie and that she murdered her husband. Somebody actually said this.
Yeah.
What happened to her?
I think it's like people remember being on this like trip and hearing this, but like, I just honestly feel it's like we were sitting around a campfire and someone thought it was funny to like.
Yeah, like somebody had a little too much to drink.
Yeah. And then she said, oh, I went back east and lived my life and then came back.
But did anyone investigate this woman?
No, but it has helped fuel the rumors that Bessie is alive and well. But one of the more ongoing rumors is connected to this woman named Georgie Clark, who actually was the first woman to make it down the Colorado just much later. Georgie, I get the sense, is someone you might call a character. And she, despite having this amazing achievement, was not supportive of other women attempting to do the same. She largely felt like she was unique in her experience of going down the Colorado.
Mm.
But she did serve as a river guide for much of her life. And when she passed away in 1992, at the age of 81, friends learned that her name was actually Bessie, not Georgie.
Okay.
And so everyone was like, is this the Bessie?
Yeah.
I mean, Bessie was a popular name. In fact, we've done another missing woman story on a Bessie, but they also find in her underwear drawer a gun.
Okay.
And Glenn and Bessie's marriage certificate.
For real?
Yeah. So that feels like something, right?
Well, doesn't it?
Doesn't it? Ultimately, though, like, Bessie's last name was actually DeRoss, and she had lied about many things in her life. Basically, she started a new life after a hit-and-run death of her daughter in 1944. But Georgie, as I'll call her, doesn't look like Bessie Hyde at all. She was much taller than Bessie, for instance.
Okay.
As for the marriage certificate, some friends have theorized that she used it as a prop on some of her tours and that she left it in there as kind of a joke or gag to make you wonder who she really was. Like,
maybe because she did the same river thing and her name was actually Bessie.
Yeah,
and like all like of this
maybe,
stuff.
Maybe, yeah. And you can actually order marriage certificates that are not your own. So, like, maybe she did that. I don't know.
Could she have gone a little bit crazy after the death of her daughter?
Well, I mean, I think, like, she reinvented herself, basically. And, yeah, I think she was an interesting and tough lady. But,
There's nobody we talked about today that is not an interesting character.
Right. They're all.
This is, yeah.
Yeah. And so what I think, though, is like a pretty clear progression of events. Like you have a man who's like a bit overconfident in his abilities, who has done white water rafting before, but like not the Colorado.
Right.
You have a woman with zero river experience. You have documentation of both of them ending up in the river. You have their desire not to have life preservers or any life-saving stuff on their boat. You have people who are warning them, hey, the river is terrible ahead, and them being like, oh, the worst is already over.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you also have Killer Fang Falls, which is a pretty...
Sounds pretty terrifying.
Dramatic rapid situation. Yeah. So, despite all that, many people really do wonder if Bessie survived this and thrived after her experience.
That's not your opinion, though.
Yeah. I mean, I usually try not to insert too much of my opinion of what happened. I mean, I think as these episodes progress, I do more and more so. But, like, I mean, I think that there's, like, this will or this, like, romanticism that's involved in, like, believing that she, like, lived some sort of outlaw life. But at the same time, like, Bessie was not an outdoor cat like Glenn was. And if I think through, like, what would Bessie do if that happened, if she survived this, like, wouldn't she be doing her art career or, like, doing meeting up with Greta or...
Yeah.
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 Yeah. But, you know, we always end with a poem that I've written in honor of the women, and we will. It's actually a new poem, so it's not in my book, but I wanted to make space here before that happens for one of Bessie's, since the world should hear her and remember her as an artist and a poet. So this is one of Bessie's. Bessie wrote, "The first fall frost in shining silver comes at night and soon beguiles the fluttering trees with jewels. At dawn, the barren ground is carpeted with brown, dry, crackling leaves, who can no longer whisper soft, low sounds, for they are dead."
We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, A Sketch, 1928, read by Musetta Vander. A native South African, Musetta is no stranger to the entertainment world. She debuted on stage at the age of 4. One of her first jobs was anchor host for an MTV-like television show in South Africa. After her arrival to the USA, she became part of the very world she used to host, appearing as the Dream Girl in more than 20 music videos for top recording artists including Rod Stewart, Tina Turner, Elton John, and Chris Isaak. But it was her critically acclaimed stage performance in the original South African play Soweto's Burning that provided her transition to the big screen. Since then, Musetta has performed in numerous feature films, including Wild Wild West, Oh Brother Where Art Thou, The Cell, Breaking Point, and Kicking and Screaming, to name a few. Additionally, she added a slew of television credits, including Stargate SG-1, Frasier, NCIS, and Criminal Minds Beyond Borders.
Whirls of charcoal. The slide of darkened fingers across paper. Across skin. The dark crease of his elbow. All memorializing the lines of his body. The sharp turn of his jaw. What drives this desire? The need to capture the perfect violet dawn, or the way the canyon spine cuts through the desert. Your perspective flattens this vast wild. Even the dark ink of your pen sees nothing of the way the water purls around you. And the wander-strung terror thudding through your ribcage cannot be found in the delicate shadows you etch beneath your husband's eyes. He wants the world to see you. Want to press your own body against the earth. Want to leave a cyanotype of limbs, shoulders, the stark whisper in the endless night when you ask him to save you from the dark machine of the river. The endless churn of its engine that once felt like God's hand, but is simply that old prophecy machine, delivering fortunes with its every breath.
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.